Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 30, 2023. We have four cases on our calendar, two for oral consideration. The first one being A221384, Sawmill Golf Club versus Ramsden. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal at your option. We have read all of the materials, including the motion papers. We will consider those the motion papers in light of the law and the rules, and we've read all of the materials in this case. I'd ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking, and with that, we are ready to proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Vivian, and along with Melissa Hodge, we represent the appellant in this matter, Sawmill Golf Club, Inc. The president of Sawmill, Dan Pohl, is in the gallery today. Sawmill built and owns and operates the Loggers Trail Golf Course in the city of Grant. And that course is on land leased from the respondents, Bruce and Barbara Ramsden. The parties entered into an addendum to their lease agreement that granted Sawmill the option to purchase the golf course property. And Sawmill attempted to exercise that option, and ultimately this litigation ensued. Before I get to the key issues on appeal, I want to talk about a few ancillary issues, one of which Your Honor referenced. The Ramsdens, in their brief, claim that our brief is noncompliant, and they also brought a motion to strike part of our reply brief. And for the most part, I'll rely on our papers for those arguments, though I do want to address one of the arguments about our brief being noncompliant with the rules. The Ramsdens had argued that the challenged findings and conclusions were not identified in our brief. That's incorrect. The challenged findings and conclusions are the same that we challenged in our motion for amended findings before the district court, and those are findings of fact 24, 25, and 27, and conclusion of law 1, and those findings and conclusions are listed on page 6 of our principal brief. As I mentioned, I'll rely on our briefing.
Findings 24, 25, and 27 are findings of fact, correct?
Correct. We'll rely on our briefing on those other issues, including the motion to strike. If necessary, I'll address those on rebuttal. I do want to address one more ancillary point about what's not at issue today. As the court is undoubtedly aware, at the Ramsden's request, their cross appeal was dismissed by an order dated January 25, 2023. And the issues in that cross appeal are not before the court today, including the enforceability of the addendum. The district court, at least implicitly, concluded the addendum was enforceable. That judgment stands. The Ramsden's alleged damages based on agreements to waive cost of living adjustments and revenue shares. District court denied those damages. That also stands. As does the issue of whether the Ramsdens are entitled to attorney's fees and costs. The district court denied those damages, and that judgment stands. So now that we've talked about some of the ancillary issues, let's talk about the real issue here. The district court found that the Ramsdens did not fail to act in good faith solely because of the language in the addendum that said they had the right to set the terms of the contract for deed.
Do I understand that at the time of trial, there really was no dispute about the purchase price? There was an agreement about the, what was it, $10,500 per acre. And so what was left to try was the question of whether there's breach by failing to, in good faith, negotiate the remaining terms and conditions. Is that
I
the
think
argument?
That's right, Your Honor.
All and, right. And that,
go ahead.
That same claim, as I understand it, is the basis of the claimed breach of the duty of implied good faith and fair dealing.
Correct.
On that question, I've reviewed the complaint several times. You didn't plead an implied duty claim.
We do reference good faith, but there is not a specifically pled implied duty of good faith and fair dealing claim.
So how can we fault the district court for failing to make a ruling on that specifically?
It's a good question, Your Honor. Mr. Olson, on behalf of the Ramsdens, at the beginning of the trial, brought a motion to exclude evidence on the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim, even though the parties had litigated it for about a year and a half at that point. And the first 21 pages of the trial transcript address the motions brought pre-trial, the parties' various arguments, and I believe it's on page 21 where Judge Green denies those motions. So if the
I think the court, I'm looking at page 20, yeah, talks about litigating things by express or implied consent
Correct.
Of the parties.
Correct. And if the Ramstons disagreed with that ruling, they certainly could have raised a cross appeal on that. It wasn't, I don't believe, in the issues they did raise, and now that they've voluntarily dismissed their cross appeal, that issue's not before the court. And the point that Your Honor brought up about the agreement on the price, there seems to be some maybe disagreement on the appellate briefing about whether there was an agreement on price. So I just wanted to bring the court's attention to just a brief part of the trial transcript, which is at page 353 and 354. And this is my cross-exam of Bruce Ramsden. And I asked him, question, and on 12/30/2019, you sent Dan Pohl this document, right? It's entitled Contract for Deed Terms. Answer, okay. Question, and you, me asking Bruce Ramsden, and you set the price there at $1.6 million, correct? Answer, that is correct. Question, and again, you calculated that amount by taking the $10,500 per acre times 152 acres and rounded it up? Answer, correct. So yeah, in our view, there was no dispute about the price. The issue was the terms, Your Honor. And going back to...
And the terms, as I review the addendum, the terms and conditions of the contract for deed were at the discretion of the respondents.
Correct. I think they have discretion, Your Honor, but they need to exercise that discretion in good faith and without an ulterior motive intended to prevent my client from obtaining the benefit of the bargain. So,
And what evidence of an ulterior motive is in this record?
Sure. I would direct the court to pages specifically 326 and 327 of the trial transcript, where again on cross-exam, Bruce Ramsden testified about the second thoughts that he and his wife were having about selling. And when I asked why, he gave three reasons why they didn't want to sell the property now. A, they thought the property value was going up. Two, they wanted more net worth for their heirs. I think he also commented something about the value of the dollar that I didn't quite follow. And he also testified about the sentimental value of this being the farmstead of his family. So that's the evidence in the record, Your Honor, that their ulterior motive was they decided they didn't want to sell after all.
Or they didn't want to sell pursuant to the terms and conditions that were being negotiated.
I would say they set the terms and conditions in a way that they knew would be unacceptable to my client to prevent my client from exercising it, Your Honor.
But, I mean, the district court didn't find that.
Well, correct.
So what do we do with that? I mean, the district court is not crediting the argument that they acted in some sort of an unconscionable manner to deprive your, that they never had any intention of entering into an agreement.
Right. And I think the real problem here is what the district court's order doesn't say. And I would point out that the district court's order doesn't cite a single case, doesn't address any of the legal arguments that were made in both pre-trial briefing and post-trial briefing about the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing and whether the Ramsdens acted in good faith. And we raised the issue of the ulterior motive. There was no mention of that. It's not as if the court said, I've considered all that, and Mr. Vivian, you're wrong. There was no consideration of it. And the issue of whether they failed to act in good faith, in my view, is inextricably linked to the issue of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, because the only mention in Judge Green's order about why they did not fail to act in good faith, and I don't like the double negative, but that sort of is what it is that the contract, the addendum, said they had the right to set the terms. There's no analysis beyond that. And when you look at the case law we cited, the court has to engage in analysis beyond that. And the court didn't do that. And I can talk about some of the law right now.
But go ahead. I'm looking at the findings, and the court found Sawmill has failed to establish that the Ramdens failed to negotiate in good faith.
Right.
Isn't that a finding that whether you're talking about the language in the lease, the language in the addendum, or common law, there's no bad faith? Why isn't that a finding that encompasses all of the claimed theories?
Because if you look at conclusion of law one, Your Honor, in my opinion, all he's focusing and all the district court is focusing on is the issue that the contract says they have the ability to set the terms. There is no analysis beyond that. There's no mention of the law. There's no discussion of the law. It's just there's these words in this contract, and I'm not going to do anything beyond that. And I think that's an error of law, Your Honor, not necessarily an error of a factual finding.
Why is that an error of law?
let me talk a little bit about the case law, Your Honor. In Mr. Olson's brief, he talks about there not being, that there is no claim for implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Every contract in Minnesota has an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing that requires one party to a contract to not unjustifiably hinder the other party's performance of the contract. That's the NRA Hennepin County 1986 recycling bond litigation case, 540 Northwest 2nd, 494. That case is cited in Midwest and KTJ cases we cite. So,
but a party doesn't act in bad faith when they're asserting or enforcing rights that they have under a contract, which in this case, under the addendum as I read it, the respondents had the right to set the terms and conditions of this contract for deed.
Right. So I would respond to that in a few ways, Your Honor. Minnesota law, specifically Midwest, talks about a party can't, unjustifiably hinder another party's performance or deny party the benefit of the bargain, and it can't exercise its discretion with ulterior motive. And both those are present here, Your Honor. As I mentioned earlier, the Ramsden decided they did not want to sell, and they exercised their discretion to prevent Sawmill from purchasing at all.
Well, they made offers, though. You didn't like the down payment, and you didn't like the lifetime plus six-year term. But wasn't that lifetime plus six-year term completely consistent with the approach the respondents have taken throughout, is that they wanted a steady stream of income, not a big influx of cash that they would have to pay taxes on. So, I mean, how is the failure to be able to reach the contract for deed terms, how is that in bad faith when it's consistent with the party's agreement throughout in terms of periodic payments?
Sure. Let me address the issue of the lifetime payments. At trial, Bruce Ramsden testified for the first time that, that would be payments for a lifetime, but it wouldn't exceed the agreed-upon purchase price. That's inconsistent with the actual evidence in the case, Your Honor. And this is Exhibit 42, an email he sent. He imposed the minimum payments of $9,000 a month for his lifetime plus 6 months at a time when he testified he had not agreed on a purchase price. So it wasn't a circumstance where the parties had agreed on a price, and then this would just be how it was paid. He imposed that as a term, as a minimum term, at a time when there was no agreed on purchase price.
Because they're still negotiating everything at that point, right?
Our view of the case is that they had agreed on a purchase price. He testified that he did not. So other than that, I think the court's correct, Your Honor.
If I may.
Yes.
We're talking about the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Okay, assuming that is before us and we should be in all of that. It just strikes me that when we look at this, we look at the negotiation as a whole, not like, and that what you're talking about are little parts. It's like, well, they've violated the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing because of the, you know, number of months or number of amounts or number of interest, as opposed to looking at it as a whole. And if you look at it as a whole, you say, well, as you say, and as the district court found, there's basic agreement on the value of the land. You know, wouldn't that suggest, if we're looking at this negotiation as a whole to see if there's a violation, that would suggest there's not? Do you see what I'm saying? My question is more that my concern about picking apart little pieces of a disagreement as opposed to looking at it overall.
I would direct the court to what we view as the shifting sort of justifications and positions of the Ramsdens. And I won't go through all the terms now, but they're set forth at page 13 of our principal brief. These things that the Ramsdens offered at one point and then withdrew were acceptable. They just never offered them at the same time, Your Honor. And that's why I think if you look at it as a whole, there's a pattern in practice of them shifting their positions. And these are things that we've cited in our brief. October 1, 2018, Barbara Ramsden emails my client, says that she doesn't even believe Sawmill has the right to purchase. And she didn't have time to discuss it. And then a few weeks later, she sends an email saying her lawyer and tax professional said not to sign a contract for deed, despite the fact the agreement specifically says that they wanted a contract for deed, which would be consistent with what they say later about a lifetime of payments. Now she's saying to my client that they don't want to sign a contract for deed. Again, a week later, there's too many things going on. We can't talk right now. October 2nd, 2019, many months later, again raising the issue, she doesn't think Sawmill has the right to purchase the property. So I think when you look at the evidence as a whole, it's clear that Ramsden's don't want to sell the property, change their mind. It's borne out by the trial testimony. So I think that's what the record as a whole shows, Your Honor. I just have a minute left. I wanted to talk about the Sterling case, which is cited by the Ramsdens, and I think they say it obliterates our argument. We disagree strongly on that. In Sterling, there was dealing with a brokerage agreement. It's not an option agreement, so that is a big difference. In Sterling, the defendants had sole discretion, which is not a term that's in our agreement. Defendants had sole discretion to reject offers to purchase their company and did so after legitimately considering offers and finding the bids unacceptably low. So in that case, their parties had sole discretion to say yes or no, whether there's a deal or there's not a deal. The only terms of the agreement related to how the broker would get paid. That case is very different than our case. Sterling does reference Whitestone, which is a much more similar case where the lender had sole discretion, still uses that term, had sole discretion over whether environmental survey results were acceptable. In that case, the other party said, yeah, they rejected the environmental survey results, but they did so with an ulterior motive. And the court said, denied a motion to dismiss on that basis, saying, yes, it has to go forward. You just can't decide the deal you don't like anymore. And I'll be back on rebuttal.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Mr. Olson.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Olson. I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, Bruce and Barbara Ramsden, in this matter, counsel. I first want to just quickly address a couple of the points raised by Mr. Vivian here. There was an issue in our motion to strike involving this quote involving the October email that my client sent to Sawmill, where she said that they didn't have to sell. Well, what Sawmill didn't mention in any of its pleadings is the fact that that same day she said, I've looked at it now, and yeah, you do have the right to sell. The court is correct that what Sawmill's doing here is basically cherry-picking little bits and pieces of the record and documents and places and time and claiming it's the whole argument. Well, it isn't. You have to look at the entire series and sequence of events that occurred here.
One of the arguments Mr. Vivian just left with us was that the record as a whole shows that your clients were not willing to sell under a contract for deed, and so all they did was think of excuses to not do it, and that they have, you know, breached the agreement and hindered the appellant's rights under the contract. How do you address that sort of whole course of conduct argument?
Well, you look at the court's decision. The court didn't make any findings on any of those allegations. The court found, to the contrary, that my clients acted in good faith and made repeated findings my clients acted in good faith, that my clients negotiated, that the my clients had the right. Counsel says that our contract doesn't say they have the sole discretion to set terms and conditions. Well, there were no restrictions in the addendum. It said that they had the right to set the terms and conditions. And the trial court as well made that determination that, you know, Judge Green said, I don't have any basis to imply terms and conditions into this document that aren't there. The contract. And specifically, what Judge Green said was, Sawmill was given the right to purchase after any time after December 31st, 2013. In exchange for that, my clients were granted the right to dictate the terms and conditions. This is an option agreement. It has to be read strictly in favor of my clients, who are the optioners in this case.
Do you contend that either the lease or the addendum are ambiguous?
No, I mean, there is one potential ambiguity, and that's from the addendum as to whether or not there has to be negotiations before it moves on to the appraisal process, because there are two little blurbs in the addendum. Other than that, I'm not making any contention it's ambiguous. There was never an agreement on the purchase price. The court found there was no agreement. There were loose agreements on the purchase price, and what happened was that amount of $1.6 million was thrown around and thrown out there. But ultimately, Mr. Ramsden said, look, we'll agree to that $1.6 million, but you've got to agree to our terms. And the president of Sawmill said, no, we don't like your terms. We're not going to agree to them. And what it comes down to is they wanted the right to prepay, which was not in the addendum. My clients weren't willing to give them the right to prepay. And this argument that my client, for the first time on at trial, came up with this claim that this was not going to be for the lifetime under all circumstances. Well, this is the only time he testified was at trial, and when questioned by Mr. Vivian regarding, well, are there any circumstances under which this contract would end before the end of your lifetime? And Mr. Ramsden said, yeah, if I'm 110 years old, these people are 80 and 86 at the time we're doing this. Their life expectancies were less than 10 years. All of the terms and conditions proposed by my clients, doesn't matter what the interest rates were, all of them would have gone beyond that 10 years. So they were actually getting a deal here when my clients offered 6 months after their deaths. So instead of it being 12, 15, 20 years, arguably it could be 8.5 years. The bottom line is Sawmill didn't like these terms and conditions.
One of the arguments that appellant makes is that the district court erred by failing to address head-on the allegation that your client's conduct violated the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. How do you respond to that legal argument?
Counsel says that this good faith and fair dealing was tried throughout this case. No, our motion in limine sought to prevent Sawmill from making allegations that weren't contained in their complaint, period.
And that motion was denied,
No,
correct?
It was denied, right. So we didn't consent to trying that issue. And we didn't just sit back on our hands. The issue wasn't even all that big of a deal at that point in time. It was, we didn't want Sawmill doing exactly what they did, and that is bringing in all these arguments that weren't set forth in their bare-bones complaint. We wanted them to stick to their bare-bones complaint. This argument of good faith and fair dealing in any event, it doesn't apply here. We didn't say that there isn't a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. We said it doesn't apply. One of the reasons that it doesn't apply is, as Your Honor discussed, they had a contractual right to dictate the terms and conditions. And Minnesota law says you can't violate the covenant of good faith and fair dealing if you're simply enforcing a right that you've got in a contract. There are other reasons why it doesn't apply either. Minnesota law says that the actions of the quote-unquote offending party have to make it impossible for the other party to perform under the contract. This wasn't impossible for Sawmill. They just didn't like the terms and conditions. They could have accepted any number of terms and conditions along the way here, but they rejected them instead of accepting them. And then they complain that my clients shift their terms and conditions. Well, they had every right to do so. Once their terms were rejected, their offer is no longer on the table. They can make whatever offer they want. And in the context of an option agreement, technically it's over. So the first time that they rejected terms and conditions of my client, because my clients had the right to dictate those terms and conditions, that should have been the end of the game. But nonetheless, my clients continued trying to negotiate terms and conditions. And some key points are, after Sawmill decides simply to sue my clients, instead of trying to reach an agreement, even though my clients' offers were being rejected, Bruce Ramsden goes and meets with the president of Sawmill 2 or 3 weeks after the complaint's been filed in an attempt to resolve the disputes between the parties as to the sale price and as to the terms and conditions. Sawmill rejects them. There are two more occasions after December of 2018 where my clients are again proposing terms and conditions in an attempt to resolve this case. They were under no obligation whatsoever to do so. So to even allege that they acted in bad faith is ridiculous. The bottom line is we believe that the trial court was very detailed and carefully thought out the decision in this matter. There was a 3-day trial. There are pre-trial briefs or post-trial briefs. There are motions for amended findings. The trial court's decision was supported by those findings, all of which have ample support in the record. As we indicated in our brief, we went through every one of those findings and pointed to the record where there was support. The conclusion is also supported by those findings. The respondents therefore asked this court to affirm the decision of the trial court. And unless you have any questions, I have nothing further.
All right, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Vivian, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Minnesota law. Mr. Olson talks about you can't act in bad faith if you exercise a right you have in a contract. I would direct the court to Sterling, which says that you can't act with an ulterior motive. Whitestone says the same thing, as does Minwest. And the problem is there is no analysis of the ulterior motive, or either legally or factually. That's the reason the court's judgment should be reversed. So to say that, gee, if I have a right, I can exercise it however I want, is not consistent with Minnesota law. Mr. Olson said that the court found repeatedly that the Ramsdens acted in good faith. There's not a single place in the court's decision where he says they acted in good faith. He says we failed to prove they acted in bad faith, but he never says they acted in good faith.
But isn't that what you have to prove to show an breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, that they acted in bad faith?
Yes. And the problem with his decision is that his analysis is based only on language in an agreement that says they had the right to set the terms. Under Minnesota law, due to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, that's not enough. You need to go beyond that and examine whether they acted with an ulterior motive, whether they intended to hinder our performance.
I just don't understand why conclusion of law number one doesn't address all of your arguments. Sawmill has failed to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the Ramsdens breached the lease agreement and the addendum by their failure to negotiate in good faith. I mean, that conclusion seems to me to read, there's no ulterior motive, they acted in good faith, you didn't meet your burden of proof to establish that they did anything that violated anything that could, either the contract itself or the implied covenant.
Because of the next sentence, Your Honor, which is, the addendum granted Sawmill the option to purchase the property after December 31, 2013, but in return granted the Ramsdens the right to set the terms and conditions. Period. There's no other analysis. There's no analysis of any of the other arguments on the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing.
But why does the district court have to do that when it's already concluded as the lead of its conclusions of law that you didn't meet your burden of proof at trial to establish a violation of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
Because the court's view of the burden of proof is inextricably tied to the faulty legal analysis of not considering the implied covenant. That's why, Your Honor. He didn't consider the implied covenant at all. And the factual finding is inextric- inextricably linked to that. Without considering the facts under the proper legal analysis, both are flawed, Your Honor. That's why, in our view. You know, the view...
You never sought to amend your complaint. That troubles me, again, to fault a district court for not specifically addressing a claim that was never pled. I'm having a trouble with that.
And again, I would go back to the first 21 pages of the transcript where that issue was clearly identified, clearly briefed. This is not a circumstance, Your Honor, where we only raised this in a post-trial brief. I mean, this was raised during the course of litigation. It was raised in our pretrial briefing. It was raised and discussed at length on the first day of the trial.
But discussing something during trial doesn't present a claim for the district court to decide. I mean, the operative thing that the district court has to decide is there's a motion, there's a, the complaint defines what the court has to decide at the end of the trial.
There was a motion, Your Honor, and it was denied.
To amend the complaint to add a claim for a breach of the implied covenant?
No, to exclude evidence of the implied breach of the
duty. But that's an evidentiary issue. It's not a decision issue on the merits of the substantive claim.
Having reread the first 21 pages last night, Your Honor, I take a different view of that and how Judge Green approached that. And it was addressed extensively in our proposed findings, our written closing argument, and then we brought a motion for amended findings and conclusions of law. And again, there's not a single citation of a single case dealing with what is the most important issue in the case. So it's not to suggest that the court, Judge Green, was unaware of the claim or is, I mean, just not supported by the record, which makes it very clear that he was, and we discussed it, and both parties discussed it in briefing. I mean, it was fully briefed, pre-trial, post-trial, amended findings motion. And I'll just end with the last thing. The Ramstons' view of the implied covenant is that they could charge that it, they can charge 1,000% interest if they wanted, and that would not violate the implied covenant. That just can't be the law because it would deny the parties the benefit of the bargain. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is fully submitted, and we will issue our opinion with a statutory time period. Thank you.